Hello, and welcome to the latest Society for the Environment podcast in our series, Interviews with Environmental Professionals. To provide a brief introduction, we are the Society for the Environment, and we hold a Royal Charter, awarded in 2004, with a custodian of two professional registrations, Chartered Environmentalist and the Registered Environmental Technician Register. Our professional body members come from a wide range of industries and sectors, reflecting the diverse disciplines of the environmental profession. The number of experts registered as Chartered Environmentalists currently stands at over 7,400 worldwide. To view our licensed bodies or for more information about our organisation, please visit our website, socenv.org.uk. So I'm really delighted today to speak to Penny Walker. Penny helps sustainable development change agents to be more effective. She supports and energises individuals to make a real difference within their organisations as they make the journey towards sustainability. She designs workshops and meetings that enable people to have conversations that they need to have so they can change the way they work. She's an independent consultant, an experienced facilitator, trainer, coach, recognised expert and author on sustainable development, and I'm delighted to say a chartered environmentalist as well. So, hi Penny, welcome to the Society for the Environment podcast.
Thank you.
So just for starting us off, can you tell us about your current job, your current role, in a little bit of detail, please?
Yes. So I'm what's known as an independent facilitator, which means that I help people have more effective conversations about tricky things. And they might be tricky because there's conflict involved, quite strong disagreement between people about what the problem is, what the potential solutions are, or it might be that the conversations are tricky because they are very complicated and involve lots of different sectors of society or different kinds of interests. Or maybe they're just difficult. You know, people are finding it hard to find solutions to the problems. And most of the conversations that I help people to have are around sustainability topics of one kind or another. That might be climate change, either in the big kind of big picture, like what might a low carbon society look like and what might it mean for different sectors of the economy or society? Or it might be very specific, like how do we protect this community or this bit of coast from the impacts of climate change as the seas rise and things get more stormy? And sometimes it's about kind of internal strategy. So an organisation that has sustainability at its core, for example, might need to do a strategic review or might need to have a trustees away day or something like that. So sometimes the conversations are kind of about sustainability and sometimes they're in service of sustainability, even though they might be about how do we work better as a team or how do we engage colleagues more on these topics.
That's really interesting. Are you seeing a kind of increase in demand for that work in recent times?
Yes, and that falls into a few different baskets. I work mainly in the UK, and the work that I've been doing helping the Environment Agency talk to professional stakeholders and members of the public about managing the risk from flooding and coastal erosion, that's definitely increased. And reasons for that are that, broadly speaking, communities or areas of the country that thought that they'd successfully managed their flood risk are now having to face up to the fact that actually there's more risk of flooding than they had appreciated before, just as new information comes in about how the climate is changing and the impact that has on what water does. So that work is definitely around, and that's definitely increased. The thing that started to happen recently, which perhaps is a bit different, is that I've been asked to help people have perhaps deeper conversations about some of the things that are happening to our environment. There's one organisation that I've done a little bit of work for recently where they wanted to give their staff just an opportunity to sort of unload about some of the difficult emotional stuff that was going on around new data that's coming in about climate and ecological information. And that was quite unusual because there were about 20 people in the room and we met for about an hour and a half. And we just reflected on what courage means in the face of some of that information and what leadership means and what they were feeling kind of personally and how that might impact on their professional lives, but also on their personal lives. So that was quite a different sort of conversation. not a conversation of conflict or disagreement, but a conversation of reflection, quite raw emotions being shared.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and that's the sort of thing that I've helped groups with in the past, but not on a paid basis, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
The fact that an organisation felt that this was something to invest sort of time and money in to support staff to have those conversations that they might not be able to have elsewhere, that was quite new.
Yeah, that is really interesting. So clearly for a role like this, it's obvious to see those skill sets you need, both in terms of the facilitation and your knowledge. Just tell us a little bit about your background and your qualifications and how you got to this role that you do now.
Yes. It's been quite a long journey. And it's interesting that you say about the knowledge. I mean, I am a fellow of IEMA. I'm a chartered environmentalist. I kind of went through the levels with IEMA in terms of having my knowledge of kind of environmental issues and broader sustainability issues tested. But actually, my knowledge of the field of sustainability issues is not the reason people bring me in. They bring me in for my skills around managing conversations. And that's been a kind of almost like a parallel journey. My first career, I was a campaigner. I worked for Friends of the Earth on issues like domestic waste, recycling, household hazardous waste, packaging, eco-labelling in the days when that was a new thing that was first coming in.
All comes around again, doesn't it?
It does. It's been a kind of a long journey. But when I went freelance, which is nearly 25 years ago, it soon became clear that the thing that my clients needed the most that I could offer wasn't the technical expertise or knowledge, but actually the ability to listen to each other better and get through conversations, through the complexity that happens in the middle of a difficult conversation and out to the other side with something that they didn't have before. So a new level of knowledge, understanding of each other's perspectives, new agreements or decisions, better clarity on the way forward. And that's something that I've learned about through doing it and then reflecting on it through being a, if you like, part of bigger teams where there have been people with facilitation expertise kind of leading the team. And I've learned almost a bit like an apprenticeship, you know, watching really skillful people do it. And I've also been on some courses, short courses, read a lot of books. You're speaking to me, I'm in my office at home and I'm facing kind of shelves of books, and most of them are about organisations, groups, how groups work, how our minds work, what are the things that get in the way of us being really honest with each other, and what are the things that we can do to help each other be a bit braver and unpeel the layers a little bit more. And in parallel with my professional development on the kind of environment and sustainability side, I've done coaching qualifications through the Academy of Executive Coaching, and I'm also a certified professional facilitator through the International Association of Facilitators, and I'm part of the leadership team of that organisation in England and Wales. So I have two tribes, if you like. We talk about tribes a lot these days, don't we? I have a kind of sustainability tribe, and then I have a facilitation and coaching tribe. And they're such a great group of people to be part of. Facilitators are extremely generous with what they share about their knowledge and skills. You know, we're always willing to try out new bits of process, little techniques that people might have developed or learnt about in other groups. There's a lot of peer learning, and the number of budding facilitators that I've had coffee with over the years and kind of tried to help them find their place in the field. It's a very generous community, and I get so much out of being part of that profession, as well as the support and fellowship that I get through being part of the environmental profession as well.
Yeah, that's really good to hear.
I'm not sure if that really answered your question.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. And interesting that you say you've got that knowledge foundation, but then built the skill set alongside that. I think that's really interesting. People will be keen to understand that. So just tell us a little bit about some of the challenges that you've faced along the way, because obviously it's working with people and working within the environment, both of those often throw up challenging conversations.
Yes, and that's when I feel I'm really earning my money, really, when the conversations get challenging, because my role, unlike, say, when I was a campaigner and colleagues who still work in that kind of advocacy field, which there's definitely a place for, I've moved away from it. That doesn't mean to say that I don't think it's important. So often when you're in that kind of advocacy role, and some people who are, you know, in the environment and sustainability profession, they're very often in that role. It could be that they're doing that in their work with clients, or it could be that they're doing it with colleagues in their organisation, trying to kind of put the case for something. So my role is a different sort of role. I'm not advocating for particular kinds of solutions or particular understandings of the problems that we're facing as a society or the situation that we find ourselves in. My role is to notice when people are not listening to each other in a group. And I'm sure people will have come across this kind of situation where people are not really listening. They're just deciding what it is that they're going to say next. Or sometimes you're in a situation in a group where people are furiously agreeing with each other. But people need that time to get it off their chest, even if actually everyone's saying the same thing. So the challenges that I come across are helping the people who are kind of calling the meeting to think really clearly about what's the purpose of this meeting. What is it that we want to get out of having people together? To what extent is it about exchanging information or indeed just a one-way transfer of information? To what extent is it about asking people for their perspective, their information, so that we can build a richer picture of the situation? And if we're the decision makers, go away and make better decisions, better informed decisions. Or to what extent actually are the people in the room needing to come to decisions themselves collectively or create new ways forward that didn't exist before? And by helping people be really clear about that before you even start inviting people to a meeting, that can mean that people's time is better spent. Sometimes that in itself is quite challenging, helping whoever the organising team are get clear about that. And sometimes they don't agree with each other about what's open to influence. So some of my job is helping, if you like, the client team have better conversations with each other, and then designing what an event or a meeting might look like. So, you know, what are the many ways we're going to use post-its during this meeting? Or are we, shock horror, actually not going to use any post-its at all? Which conversations do we need to have as a whole group? Which conversations are going to be better had in pairs or in small groups? And all of those kinds of things that actually, until you started to think about it, you don't realise that our choices. Actually, we have so many different choices about how we run meetings, that sometimes we just follow the same old formula of everybody has to be in the same conversation at the same time, and the most senior person in the room is expected to chair the meeting. I mean, all of those things are definitely up for grabs, and that's the kind of expertise that a facilitator can bring to the design of a meeting. And then the bit where often it gets most interesting is when the meeting's actually underway and unexpected things are happening. So is there silence when you expected people to be actually full of something to say? And what does that silence mean? And I mean, it doesn't feel courageous to me, but some people say, wow, it's so courageous to say, this is interesting, this silence. What's the silence all about? Sure. Or, you know, I've noticed that only three people have been talking for the last 20 minutes. What's that about? Or, when this person said this thing just now, there was a bit of a murmur through the room. Tell me what that's about. So it's about having the permission of the group to inquire into some of the stuff that in a lot of meetings we just try to ignore. We try to pretend that everything's fine. But actually, those are the things where, oh, we're on the edge of something here. We're approaching the tender edge of this conversation. What's the breakthrough that we're about to make by being a couple of layers more honest with each other about our doubt, our discomfort, or our enthusiasm and the thing we'd really love to see, but we're somehow too afraid to say it? So my job is to kind of be confident and demonstrate my confidence that the group will have a more interesting conversation, a more productive conversation, if people are that tiny bit braver about what they're willing to say to each other, and tiny bit braver about remaining open to other people's ideas rather than sticking to the thing that they came in to say.
Sure. So can you tell us about a particular highlight that sticks in your mind from a kind of a meeting or a project that you've been involved in?
So there are a few things that stick in my mind. There was a lovely piece of work that I did for the Environment Agency a few years ago, which was about protection against flooding in a tidal river. And there were quite a lot of people resident on houseboats in the area of the river where the Environment Agency technical knowledge had led them to think they needed to put in kind of new tidal walls. And there'd been quite a breakdown of trust, I think it's fair to say, between the people on houseboats and the Environment Agency. And one of the ways that we helped to kind of build that trust again was to have very small conversations with residents. So when I say small, I mean the number of people in the conversation was very small, maybe half a dozen to a dozen people in each conversation. And we ran these kind of 2-hour conversations back to back in different people's kitchens on their houseboats. So there were no flip chart stands, there was no sticking post-it notes on the walls. All of my normal kind of things that I might do with a group were just not possible because it wasn't my territory, and also the rooms weren't set up for that. But thinking through with the client and talking to a few individuals ahead of time to work out what would work for this group of people so that they could feel properly heard and have a really good opportunity to ask all of their questions. And they had all sorts of questions that they were able to kind of ask, which they wouldn't really been able to have done in other kinds of circumstances. So what stands out for me about that was the fact that we held these meetings over the course of a weekend in people's kitchens and living rooms on boats. And that was quite unusual for me, and just in terms of where the conversations were. Another highlight that springs to mind, very different kind of situation. The client was a household name, sustainability kind of pioneer, an international fast-moving consumer goods company. And they were reviewing their kind of approach to sustainability, having had a lot of really good feedback on their previous approach, but they wanted to take it to the next level. And what they wanted from this workshop was to have their thinking really challenged. And so we brought together quite a lot of people who, in the sustainability world, you know, people would have heard of. So to a certain extent, kind of intimidating famous people in the room. And we also made sure that there were some very young people who were kind of active in kind of making a name for themselves or pushing forward their issues, but kind of too young to become famous yet, as it were. And people from different kind of think tanks and NGOs and so on in the room together. And we got really creative with it. There was a lot of drawing. There was a lot of kind of brainstorming. And we also, one of the things that we did was to, at the beginning of the workshop, ask the people in the room if we could have anybody at all, fictional character, alive, dead, human, non-human, giving us advice in this journey of what is the future for sustainable business and what will business look like in a sustainable future. Who are the people who we would want in the room giving us advice? And so the group came up with this list that included a blue whale, a child from 2050, obviously Dumbledore was in there as well.
Of course.
And a few other kind of really left field characters who could give us some wisdom, if you like. And then from time to time, we kind of stopped and asked ourselves, OK, so looking at that list, you know, whose voice do we need to hear from now? And what would they say? So it was really encouraging people to put themselves in the persona of somebody else, you know, just temporarily, just for a few seconds, and draw on some of the wisdom that maybe was inside ourselves, but without playing that kind of a game, we might not be able to draw on. And we wrote out the names of these kind of characters and assigned them to people at dinner, because it was a workshop that ran over 2 days, and there was a dinner the evening between them. And we spent a bit of time in that kind of social situation, just encouraging people to talk from the perspective that they'd been randomly assigned about what had happened during the day and what they wanted to happen tomorrow. So we were able, the client was really up for some very creative approaches, and they were very, very pleased with what they got out. They talked about it as a mind-blowing experience, and that was what they wanted. So it was really lovely to be able to help them with something very creative, because sometimes the work that needs to be done is much more kind of mechanical than that, much more pedestrian. You know, if you're planning something or going through a technical thing, you need to be paying attention to a lot of detail. You know, a facilitator will try to build in something a bit creative to kind of shake things up a little bit and help people find new energy when the energy is lagging. But it's really nice to do something very creative from time to time and to feel like people are really inspiring each other with the things that they're coming up with.
Sure. And I bet that being involved in that process will stay with them for a really long time, I'm sure.
I hope so. I think very often it's the emotional experience that helps to seal things in people's memory. And so I try to encourage people to kind of talk about how they're feeling at different points in conversations, but also I try to kind of generate an emotional experience that will be a kind of positive emotional experience for people. And sometimes, of course, there are quite difficult emotions come into the conversation, particularly if you're talking about things like climate emergency or ecological crisis or some of those other things that we do come face to face with and are often the reason why people are in the room kind of talking to each other. You can have quite neutral, objective, so-called professional conversations about those things, of course. And sometimes the emotional weight of them breaks through. So over the years, I've done things to make sure that I've got skills to deal with quite difficult emotions and to be able to kind of allow those things into the room in a way that enables people to be honest about their emotional response to the subjects that they're talking about, without that overwhelming them or overwhelming the rest of the group or kind of being awkward. You know, I do work with international groups, but a lot of the groups I work with are Brits, and, you know, we don't like this kind of stuff, or at least historically we haven't wanted to bring our emotions into things, but they're there and they break through. So being someone in the room who is able to say, I can see you feel very strongly about that, would you like to tell us about it, and to enable people to bring that in as part of their whole selves into the conversation. So over the years, I've kind of got much more interested in how I can help that. I'm not a clinician, I'm not a therapist or a counsellor, but I do quite often help people one-to-one with conversations that you might call kind of pastoral care. And I've also done mental health first aid course and things like that. So I'm definitely not equipped to be a counsellor or a therapist. That's outside of my limits. But when those things kind of come into the conversation a little bit unexpectedly, then I at least have a little bit of training and ability
You're right, there certainly is, feels quite a sea change in recent times away from that very British stiff upper lip to talking more about people's feelings and people's mental health and well-being. So that's really interesting. And again, with that wave of concern that's coming through, particularly on climate, I can see how those issues would be coming up more and more for you.
Yes. And it's interesting how many people in the coaching and facilitation field who are not necessarily professionally linked in with the environmental and sustainability field, you know, really want to hear about those things, really want to talk about them. Just last week, I did a masterclass for coaches on coming face to face with your carbon footprint and having a conversation about, you know, how people want to respond to that. And these were coaches who just work with anybody in their different kind of organisations or in their independent practice. They weren't particularly sustainability people, but they wanted to have a conversation with each other about what is their response as coaches to some of this stuff.
So when did you first kind of develop that awareness for the environment and environmental issues?
Oh, it goes way back. I mean, in our house, we had three bins that, you know, from when I was a tiny child. Yes, one of the bins was for the garden incinerator, which I don't think, I don't think we'd have now. But there was a compost bin and there was a dustbin bin. And, well, looking again at the bookshelf in front of me, somewhere there is a copy of Silent Spring that my dad gave me as a birthday present when I was about 14, which was a bit of a downer. So there were lots of things about the way my parents lived their lives that, you know, they were always out planting trees and things like that. And my mum would embarrass us hideously by being in the local paper doing her kind of one woman speed restriction and innovative traffic calming campaigning that she used to do. She is great. I'm really lucky to have them both around still. So from a very early age, there was the sense that you just did look after things. And then also that you could change things, you know, that if you were willing to speak out, then you could make a difference.
Sure. So you've talked a lot about those kind of two tracks on your career, both the kind of the environmental and the kind of coaching facilitating side. And on both parts, you talked about your IEMA membership and being a CM and also the accreditation on your facilitation side. So what does it mean to you to have that kind of that external recognition for what you do?
So it's interesting. A lot of people go for external recognition because it's directly career enhancing. I'd say that for me, it's been about actually, because I'm self-employed, I don't have a lot of benchmarks, actually. So I wanted to kind of benchmark myself, check that even though my knowledge of environmental issues is not what clients bring me in for, that at least I've got some kind of range of knowledge so that I can spot the things that I do need to spot, like if the conversation is going slightly off track or if there are stakeholders who need to be brought into the conversation who are somehow missing. So it's helpful for me to know a bit about that. So I wanted to benchmark myself, really. And there's also something about the network, how important I find it to be able to find my tribes. Again, as a self-employed person, I'm not self-employed because I don't like connecting with other people. You know, I actually really like connecting with other people. So on both of my kind of twin track professions, if you like, the networking and the finding other people who are doing interesting things or have got something interesting to say or have got interesting challenges that illuminate work that I might be doing with clients, that's always really valuable.
And so I've had the pleasure of coming along to one of your female CEO lunches as well. And I really enjoyed it. Again, just taking the time out to talk to people with similar challenges and similar opportunities. It does really give you a different perspective on things as well. So,
yes. And one of the things that I've got much more interested in the last few years is how to support people who may be feeling a bit isolated. So I've always been really interested in the role of the in-house sustainability professional or the in-house environment professional. And the book that I wrote for IEMA, Change Management for Sustainable Development, is all about understanding as a potentially a lone person inside an organization or as somebody who's maybe part of a very small team within an organization, what can you do to help that organization recognize its role in building a better future and kind of create change inside an organization? Because I think a lot of sustainability and environmental professionals come into it with a lot of technical knowledge about either the field as a whole or a particular specialism within it. And what they really need once they're inside an organization and trying to kind of show some leadership is understanding of how organizations work and how people work and the kind of the unwritten side of that or the sure. The informal side of that, as much as, you know, how does our organization say it makes decisions, but how does it really make decisions? And who do you really need to talk to and get on side in order to be influential? So I'm interested in supporting those people, and I'm interested in bringing them together for the kind of moral support and problem solving that you get from talking to people who are your peers, who are kind of facing the same kinds of problems. And I think you need a sense of trust and a slight sense of privacy to be able to have some of those conversations. And again, that's something that I'm really used to kind of providing through my facilitation work. So I love bringing people together. So you talked about the CEO lunches, but also I've been involved with She Is Sustainable and She Is Still Sustainable for either young women just entering the sustainability profession or older women who've been around the block a few times and maybe taking stock at a midpoint or later in their careers. I love enabling people to have those conversations, you know, the surprising conversations that they might not be able to have in other circumstances, that then help them get re-inspired, get re-energized and roll their sleeves up and
go again.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So what advice would you give to younger people thinking about a career in the environment?
I'm pausing because whenever I have a conversation with somebody who wants a bit of advice, you know, the thing I do is ask them what they want. You know, what's their dream? What's the dream work? You know, if an email popped in unexpectedly from, you know, a headhunter or something offering them their dream job, what would it be? And well, I'm interested in asking people about, you know, what else is going on in your life apart from the way that you earn your living? You know, what's important to you? Is it community? Is it family? Is it traveling? You know, is there a garden that you want to nurture? What else is important to you? And as much as possible, you know, don't compromise on those things. Find something that will enable you to do what delights you, because if you do what delights you, then you're going to, you know, that's what you're going to bring your best knowledge, skills, energy, enthusiasm to. And the other thing is contact. It's all about who you know and getting advice from them, getting the inside track on things. And that's a wonderful thing for those people who've got contacts. It's a paradox for people who are trying to break into the field and maybe they don't know people who are there already. So I think it's on all of us who can give a helping hand to people to pay particular attention to people who are maybe unrepresented in our profession, be that because of ethnicity or social class or whatever it might be. Let's make this profession really welcoming to everybody, because goodness knows we need everybody's talents, don't we, to get through this. So let's try and make ourselves a welcoming profession.
I couldn't agree with you more on both of those points. Very, very wise words. So what's next for you?
Immediately, I'm working on a workshop that I'm running this week. I'm running two workshops for different sets of staff from the same organisation. It's a strategy review. They're an organisation that's intimately tied up with the kind of sustainability world. So I'll be preparing some flip charts and liaising with the venue to make sure that we get the tables laid out properly. I'm also working with three different sets of women to hopefully bring She Is Still Sustainable to London again next year, but also potentially Leicester and Manchester. And we've also got the AGM of the International Association of Facilitators England and Wales branch, which is going to be a virtual meeting. I'm trying to get as experienced as possible in running virtual meetings, because I think although face-to-face is definitely the best way to meet, we all need to reduce the amount of travel that we're doing. And so getting better at helping people make really good use of virtual meetings is something that I'm trying to get a lot of experience into.
Yeah, sure. We echo that as well. Making use of technology when you can. Absolutely. So thank you. I'm going to finish on a quite a big question, maybe take you back to your kind of activist days. So if you were able to influence world leaders for a day, what would be the first thing that you would do?
So I'm pausing again. And, you know, really, what would be the first thing I would do? The first thing I would do is to get them to go outside, look at something that's alive, and ask them, what is it that they really care about?
Interesting. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Some really wise words in there. We will link in the show notes details of the book that Penny's mentioned, and She Is Sustainable and She Is Still Sustainable, and all of those other wonderful things as well. Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure. Really great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Emma.
Brilliant. Thank you. So if you're curious to hear more about the CEMV or the RM for Tech registers, please take a look at our How to Become or Why Become recorded webinars on our website, socemv.org.uk. You can visit our YouTube channel, Society for the Environment, where they're available alongside our fascinating environmental webinar series, where you can like and subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter at socemv_HQ to keep up with all of the Society's latest news. And we will release a new episode on the first Wednesday of every month. So if you're interested in our future podcasts, please subscribe to hear more from us. You can subscribe and review through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher.